This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Hey, let's talk AI. Chatbots, artificial intelligence, they are capturing headlines right now. Applications for this new tech, they're exciting, they're surprising, and of course, come with risks. So now AI is helping people who are vision impaired navigate the world around them, and the benefits could be powerful. Boston Globe technology writer Hiawatha Bray is here in Studio 2 to tell us about it for Tech Talk. Welcome back.
Oh, glad to be here.
All right, so what we have, as I understand it, is a sort of 100-person trial of the newest version of OpenAI with people who are visually impaired.
Okay, let's even take this earlier on. Okay,
all right,
here we go.
Back it up.
Everybody's heard of GPT-3, which is the large language model that they use to build some of these amazing AI capabilities, like, of course, we've seen ChatGPT.
Right.
Well, about, a week and a half ago, they unveiled GPT-4, which is supposed to be an amazingly more powerful system. Now, if you use it for the kinds of things you've used these chatbots for in the past, it seems like it's a little improvement, but nothing overwhelming. But the thing that leapt out at me was the word that this is now capable of interpreting visual data. You can show it a picture of something, and it will tell you what it's looking at, which actually, that's not new. There are some services that already do, like Google Lens. You can shoot a picture of a flower, and it tells you what kind of flower it is.
Yeah.
But this goes far beyond that. It can tell you what's in that picture and actually interpret that information in useful ways. And this is not yet available to the general public, but OpenAI, which makes GPT-4, reached out to companies that make apps to help people who are blind or visually impaired. They talked to two different companies. One is called Envision, and the other one is called Be My Eyes. Be My Eyes is a particularly interesting example. They've been around for years. What they are is an app where people volunteer. Up to 6 million people worldwide have volunteered to do this. They volunteer to take messages from people who need something explained to them visually. So you have the app on your phone, and a blind person calls in and says, "You're a Be My Eyes volunteer. Here's a picture of what I'm looking at. Can you tell me what this is?"
So, for example, which of these is the blue striped shirt? Which of these is the red striped shirt?
Exactly. And a human volunteer, and there are about 6 million of them worldwide, have said, "I'll do that for you." It's a brilliant idea. Huge numbers of blind people have really loved it. But what if you didn't need the volunteers? What if there was a piece
on
of
demand,
software that could actually answer such questions if you just showed them a picture?
So listen, I want to illustrate this for listeners. We pulled a little sound from a promotional clip from Be My Eyes about this trial. So this is a young woman who's visually impaired. She's using AI technology to help her read a menu at a restaurant. And she explains how the tech is providing clear, nuanced answers for her.
What's really good about this is I don't just like point and then it just reads everything out at me. It like gives me like, what do I want to choose on the menu? So it's obviously like giving me the headings and then said, do you want to know it in more detail? And I'm like, ooh, maybe I want to know the details so I can peruse more.
Which is what a human volunteer would be able
exactly.
to do for you.
It would actually say, okay, here's the menu. Which of these items look good to you? And they say, or sound good to you, because you can't see
right.
it. And then if you ask for information
about
that.
I'm in the mood for fish.
I'm in the mood for fish. Here are all the items on the menu that relate to fish, and it ignores everything else.
This,
it actually reads it and understands it.
And this really could be transformative.
Oh, absolutely. She was talking about how she couldn't find her way in a subway. She asked somebody to simply guide her to a subway map. She took a picture of the map and then said, how do I get from Heathrow Airport to this area in London called Euston? And it told her just by looking at the map, and it figured it out. She said she was in tears. She said for the first time in years, she'd been blind for 10 years now, she felt like she could walk around in the subway and find her way around.
Same
user. She is a British journalist named Lucy Edwards who tried this out, and she's just in awe of it. And there's another company, Envision, that I said is also using this. They have a device based on Google Glass where you wear the headset, and it takes pictures of things and does basically the same thing. It tells you what you're looking at, and you can ask questions about what you're looking at. It isn't just telling you what you're looking at. It lets you get further information. You can look in your refrigerator, see what food is in there, and then say, what can I make with this? And it will tell you what you can make with this. It's an amazing idea.
So Hiawatha, let's back up, because you started by backing me up
and saying, let's go
from 3.0 to 4.0, right?
Exactly.
How did we make this quantum leap to a 4.0 that can do this level of assistance for example, in this case.
Well, I'm not sure what all they did, but obviously one of the things they did was they must have massively expanded their training set and included huge amounts of additional information, because these things are figuring this stuff out for themselves. And of course, I've talked about this before. One of the really odd and disturbing things about AI like this is that the people who build it couldn't probably tell you exactly how it learns to do what it does.
Right. But it's a bit of a black box.
That's right. It is worth noting that this is the same software that interprets text. It's the same program. That's what's so amazing about it. The same program can understand what you're saying when you ask it a question. It can look at a picture and understand what the picture is. You can tell it. This is it's the same software that does this thing called DALL-E, where you tell it, here's what I want a picture of, and it will create a picture of something based on what you tell it to do.
Give me a poker playing dogs in the pointillist style using only primary colors.
Absolutely.
And it could do that.
If you sat down and turned on DALL-E, it would give you that. In about 20 seconds, you would see that.
Not sure I'd want to see that, by the way.
It would be strange.
All right, so here's the thing, Hiawatha, and I bring it up every time we talk about AI, and I'm going to keep bringing it up because it doesn't seem to me that our public discourse and our regulatory discourse is getting better on this. This is hugely promising and also potential to be hugely troubling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The thing that bothers me most of all, we've talked about this before, it's the famed explainability problem. How does it know what it knows? To their credit, by the way.
Meaning that we can't explain how it knows.
We can't explain how it knows what it knows. Like, Microsoft is doing a great job on that with Bing's AI, because whenever it gives you an answer, it always gives you footnotes. It always says, here's how I learned this, here's how I learned that. So they are really grappling with this problem of telling you, here's how I know what I know. And that's not necessarily the end of the world for some applications. The real problem is that little by little, without thinking about it, we're plugging AI into almost everything. In some cases, it's no big deal. But when AI is being made to help in life and death decisions, in law, in medicine, in your education, how in the world are we going to be absolutely sure we can trust what it's doing when we don't know what it's doing?
So two things. I think I understand better than I used to that the way these open AI applications work is I'm going to use a whole bunch of just layperson's language here. They don't think. They go out and grab clusters of language, words.
Right.
Recognize the patterns in those clusters of words, and therefore put other clusters of words after that would. And so there's no thinking involved
there's
here.
No
this is
thinking
pattern
involved.
Recognition.
Pattern recognition. These things do not think at all, and so they make really weird mistakes. Like, you know, I was just talking to you about Google. They've just launched theirs. If you've tried the Microsoft version, Bing Chat, now Google has launched their version called Bard. And I was checking it out the other day. I'm originally from Chicago. I asked it about what the Bears are going to do in the NFL draft, and it gave great answers. Like, the Bears have already traded away. They had the first pick of the draft. They've traded to the ninth pick of the draft to get this new receiver and so forth and so on. And then they started saying, and they're trying to get this new linebacker who will be perfect to play alongside Khalil Mack. The Bears traded Khalil Mack a couple of years ago. He doesn't play there anymore.
So how did they miss that?
How did they know how recent, like within days of my asking that question, they had made these moves in the draft and this AI knew it? But years ago, they traded this guy, and the AI didn't know it.
Yeah, because it's just pulling these clusters.
It's just, exactly.
And then that raises the other problem, and we've talked about this. We talked about this with Google Face Recognition a couple of years ago.
Right.
We are feeding algorithms. We're feeding content that inherently has bias in
it. Absolutely.
And if it learns off of bias, and then, as you say, we begin to incorporate it into our everyday lives, we could be inadvertently living lives of bias.
Okay, well, we all do anyway, but the point is when a computer is doing it, when you automate bias, the problem could be a million times more dangerous. Like, you know, there's been a ton of stuff that people have been writing about that lately. Wired has this whole big thing that they just did about the problems with, like, there's a welfare system in Copenhagen, Denmark, which is using AI to try to decide who should get welfare benefits. And there have been all these complaints about unfair decisions being made by it. And this is a global thing. It's happening worldwide. And the political and moral ethics that we would want to bring to bear on these decisions, how do we teach a machine to execute those decisions?
How do we put those
in place? And we're not clear on that. Look, I don't want to freak out about this. These are all problems I think that can be solved. And I think the benefit of these things is going to be absolutely amazing. You know, the other problem is, you know, you wonder if it's going to make people too predictable, too dull, too boring. And that's one of the possible outcomes of the other big thing that happened recently in AI, which is Microsoft Copilot.
Yeah.
So which I think is hugely important.
So this is like fixing the paperclip, the old Microsoft paperclip. Right.
Well, how many people remember Clippy the paperclip?
Oh, I think we all remember, but not for good reasons.
Yes. Yeah. But no, but this is an attempt to automate and build right into practically every Microsoft product an AI system that will automatically give you suggestions, ideas, help you do whatever work it is you're doing. And it covers an amazing variety of stuff. Do you want to build a PowerPoint presentation about something? Tell it what you want the PowerPoint presentation to be about, and it will build you a basic entry-level PowerPoint presentation that you can then go in and edit. You don't have to do all that stuff. You just tell, here's what I want the slides to look like. Here's what they got to say. You just give it all that stuff. Bang, it's done.
So I not only wouldn't have to be sizing my own rectangles, but also putting the basic content in it. It would do that for me.
You just tell it what you want, and it can build a basic version of it. If you're doing spreadsheets, how many people really understand Excel? I don't use it that much. Exactly. Suppose there's something in Excel you want to do, like a what if. You're trying to look at what third quarter earnings would be if you introduced this new product.
Or the dreaded pivot table.
Or exactly. Something like that. You just tell it, build me that. And it is going to do that for you. You're not going to have to understand Excel anymore. Hmm. You just need a list of all the things that Excel can do. Then you say, can you do this with Excel? Do it for me. I don't want to know. And it will just automatically do it. That's hugely useful. It also has some interesting implications for long-term, you know, the employment of white-collar workers. It's not going to instantly throw people out of jobs. It just means that companies are going to need fewer people to do what they already do. It's not going to cause a mass layoff kind of thing. It's just going to mean we're not going to have to hire that guy. We're not going to have to hire that guy. And that is another one of the huge implications we have to face. We're used to the idea that technology is going to get rid of jobs at the bottom end of the scale. All of these new technologies, they're getting rid of the jobs of lawyers. Some cases, they're going to get rid of the jobs of radiologists.
And you know, you know? Those who, for example, in the transportation industry would say, I'm not used to that. But what I think you're saying is nobody wants to get used to that.
Exactly. But it's going to happen. It's not like, again, it's not going to be mass layoffs. It's going to mean a law firm isn't going to need as many paralegals. It's not going to need as many attorneys doing basic scut work because the computer will do it for you now. We've already got radiologists working side by side with AI that are, because AIs can see things on an X-ray or a CT scan that a human can't see. And this is going to just keep happening. And Microsoft Copilot is now pushing that down the stack and making it something that's going to be happening on every level of white-collar work.
Well,
it's really going to change things. It's not sexy, but it might be the most important AI thing I've seen so far.
Well, that means you're going to follow it, and we're going to follow it with you. Boston Globe technology writer Hiawatha Bray, every other week, Tech Talk, always fascinating. Thanks for coming in.
Happy to be here.
In the early 1940s, a teenager, not yet 16, arrived in Roxbury from Lansing, Michigan, to live with his half-sister. Over the next decade, he would go back and forth between Boston, Harlem, the Midwest, working menial jobs, listening to a lot of live Boston jazz, and running afoul of the law. During years of incarceration in the state's prison system, he would begin to study and eventually would convert to a religious practice that defined the rest of his short life. His name, Malcolm Little, when he arrived in Roxbury, we know him as Malcolm X. Did you know that history? Many people would say no, and that's what we're here talking about today in this month's edition of Yes And, which is our deep dive into culture. Our Yes And guide, as always, is Kelly Carter Jackson, Associate Professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College, and also with us, Dart Adams, a journalist, a historian, and the host of Dart Against Humanity and Boston Legends podcasts. Kelly, welcome back.
Hi there. Good, happy to be here.
And Dart, great to have you in studio, too.
Oh, absolutely. Great to be here.
So, Kelly, when did you first learn about Malcolm X's history in Roxbury?
Oh, man. Well, I read his autobiography when I was probably in high school, but I don't think I really connected him living in Boston. Mostly I connected him with Harlem. It wasn't until I moved to Boston as a postdoc that I realized the deep, rich history that he has here, the mosque that he worshipped here. There's, you know, sort of murals around the city for him. And I started to connect the dots and realized, wow, he really did spend a lot of time in Boston, and I don't think people are aware of how rich that history is.
So, Dart, you know, his history so physically present for you. You live in Roxbury at one time, right across the street from the house that he moved into with his half-sister. Talk about this strange constant presence and constant invisibility of Malcolm X's time in Roxbury and kind of our collective Boston psyche.
All right, so I grew up in Mass Ave between Columbus and Tremont, and directly across the street from me was his sister, but she was old and infirmed, and like people in the community used to always bring stuff to her, bring stuff up to her in the buckets because she was in a wheelchair. But like right down the street from me on Mass Ave was the Savoy Cafe, which was at the time Skippy White's and is now Cutting Edge Barbershop. And they were like, Malcolm X used to hang out there. When we go to the Christian Science Plaza, they say, well, that was the Roseland State Ballroom where Malcolm used to hang out. And around, people say, that's Chicken Lane. That's where Malcolm X, along Mass Ave, that used to be Chicken Lane. That's where Malcolm X recruited Louis Farrakhan, Louis X. We go around the corner, there's 5 Wellington. It's like in 1953, Malcolm, Lloyd X, who was a musician at all these Boston jazz places along Mass Ave where I lived, which was called the Jazz Corner, is like, this is where Lloyd X allowed Malcolm X, when he was sent by Elijah Muhammad to Boston to recruit, had his meetings. And this is where he recruited 50 to 100 of the Boston Roxbury, you know, ministers. And when you think about it, Malcolm X and Louis X are by far the most accomplished and well-known ministers of the Nation of Islam. And that's not by coincidence.
This was one of the things also, Kelly Carter Jackson, that was really striking to me is, and listen, okay, first, I want to acknowledge last week, month when we talked with you, one of the things that we talked about is this false structure that we create of the Malcolm versus Martin. Right.
Yeah.
And I want to note that. And I also want to bring it back on the table today because, for example, I'm very aware of both 12th Baptist Church and Mosque Number 11. I was very aware of Martin Luther King Jr.'s presence at the 12th Baptist Church.
Yeah.
Not at all aware, Kelly, of Malcolm X's presence with Mosque Number 11.
Yeah, we don't seem to talk about these spaces in which Malcolm is moving and operating, especially as it relates to the Nation of Islam. And I think part of that is because there weren't the historical markers there. There weren't spaces that were being preserved that were sort of deemed as hallowed ground or hallowed space in which people could go and interact. So I'm really excited being a part of the Massachusetts Historical Commission. You know, when I saw we get places and how houses and buildings all the time that come on our docket, and we vote whether or not they're going to be a part of, you know, the National Historical Registries list. And when I saw that Malcolm Little / the Ella Little Collins house was on the docket, I was like, oh my God. It's like, this is huge, because it means that when homes like this, when they get preserved, when they get national historical designations, it means they can get funds, they can have access to grants, they can get preserved and restored. You can put the historical marker so that when you're walking down the street, you just don't pass it by and not know who lived there or what happened there. And I think these historical markers are so important because they're physical signposts to the history that we all sort of live our lives in, but to a past that is very much with us.
I want to pick that up. So in 2020, the house is designated with the National Register of Historic Places. 2005, the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem opens as a museum dedicated to Malcolm X. 1998, the house where Malcolm X lived with his sister, you just talked about it, designated as a landmark by the city. DART, you talked about all this presence that you increasingly became aware of. How does it make a difference? Would it have made a difference to have those things physically marked and acknowledged by our collective state, a small s? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I mean, yes, but also we have to remember that, like, back in 1980, the state went through and they like put signs on different things for the 350th anniversary of Boston. And they had a limited amount of time to put markers on certain things, but they didn't go deeper into the things that had significance to Black Boston's communities, you know? Mm-hmm. And among them, you know, should have been the NAACP building on Mass Ave, you know, should have been a whole bunch of other places. But when you think about Malcolm X and his role in Boston, like, he was a member of the Towson Street Church right there in Roxbury. You know, people don't talk about that. The Roseland State Ballroom, we all talk about, no longer exists. I haven't seen pictures of it, and I research for a living. Like, there are so many things that, like, places Malcolm was, you know, the different, like, drugstores used to hang out in Roxbury no longer exist. There's some, like, the place he used to hang out in Harvard Square, that's gone, because when Harvard did its reconstruction, they completely razed that house.
Because it hadn't been recognized as historical.
Yeah, it hadn't been recognized as a historical landmark. So there are
and
all
that's
these.
That's the problem when you don't have those designations, you're fair play for someone to come in to buy it, to develop it, to destroy it. They make it off limits. They make that particular space or place off limits.
I mean, also the fact that Malcolm was such an ingrained part of Roxbury's Black community, that mm-hmm. automatically meant that a whole lot about him and his time here was going to be erased. Because when I was a kid growing up on Mass Ave between 1975 and the 80s, at the time, every third building was burnt out or everything was a shell of what it used to be. So people used to say that was this jazz club, that was this lounge, that was this place was, you know, and I never read about it in a history book. Nobody ever did a documentary about it. So that's easy. It was easily how Malcolm's history was erased in Boston.
I want to pick
we
up.
Should
a,
also, oh.
Well, just let me reset quickly. We're talking to Dart Adams, a journalist, historian, and host of multiple podcasts. Kelly Carter Jackson, our monthly guide through our Yes and Culture segment. You're an associate professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Pick that up, Kelly, and then I have a couple of follow-up questions.
Yeah.
For the two
so
of you.
In 1965, the house is firebombed while Malcolm X is there. You know, Malcolm X's life was constantly
his
being
house,
targeted.
The house he was living
and
in.
The house that him and Ella lived in, and he escaped unharmed. But a week later, he's assassinated in the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem.
At 39 years old.
And so right after that, you know, Ella Little Collins decides to stay at the house. But, you know, the house needs repair. And then pretty much after that, she leaves the house, even though she still owns the house. But it was left dormant for about 30 years. No one really touched this home.
So I want to pick just a quick sparkle. Dart, a couple of minutes ago, you made reference to the NAACP house on Massachusetts Avenue.
Yes.
I'm assuming that that's the one from the original creation of the NAACP in the late 1800s.
Yeah, because many of the people from the NAACP came out of the Niagara movement, which were from Roxbury. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so just another illustration of missing history that All right. So the other thing that I want to lean fully into now, Dart and Kelly, is our white psyche and consciousness about Malcolm X and the Black Boston psyche and consciousness about Malcolm X, which seem, and again, I'm going to make as a device this comparison to Martin Luther King Jr. Mm. Both died, both were assassinated, widely reviled by many parts of the country. Both over time have been reconsidered in a larger historical context. Mm. But it seems that Martin Luther King Jr. reconsidered by the white community in a way that Malcolm X wasn't. And I understand that is packed. There's concerns about the Nation of Islam and anti-Semitism kinds of things. Yeah. So I just want to acknowledge all that. But how much of this is because Malcolm X is, as Dart has said, considered so differently in Boston's Black community than perhaps in Boston's white community?
I mean, the thing is that Martin Luther King Jr. came here as a student and was embraced by Roxbury and South End and Boston's Black community, whereas Malcolm X was a part of it. Even before he moved here as a teenager,
embraced versus
he
embedded.
Kept coming back here to visit Ella Collins and whomever she was married to or meeting his cousins. So his idea of what Blackness could be, his idea of what autonomous being an autonomous person could be, his idea of fighting against the man or trying to get over a hustle, he learned that all in Roxbury. So Black Boston has a different connection to Malcolm X because he's one of us. He is intrinsically a Black Bostonian. And nobody ever listens to Black Boston about anything. If you saw the documentary about Bill Russell, they didn't talk to any Black Bostonians who knew him, were friends with him, any of the people he taught at the Freedom School. So our story is never used or utilized when it comes to encompassing our own history.
So Kelly, put that critique of how we tell our stories in the context of the way you look at it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a big part of it is respectability politics. When you think about King is coming here to get his PhD at BU. He is middle class. He's well respected. He's Christian. He checks all of the markers of what is acceptable and respectable in the Black community. And Malcolm X is the complete opposite of that. He's not Christian. He's Muslim. And he has a criminal background. And he's very much pushing a Black nationalist ideology. And white people people didn't understand that. And so even though Martin and Malcolm had very similar goals and even very similar values, because of the way, because of the optics and the way that they were positioned as being binaries to one another, good, bad, you know, respectable, not respectable, we see how they get canonized throughout history as being one being a hero and the other being a villain,
which is odd because they occupied the same neighborhood at the same time in 1953.
Yes. And so, it's I mean, but this happens a lot. Do you know what I mean? We do this a lot with Black leaders. We pit one against the other and we make people choose who is going to be, you know, the savior or the hero or who is more, you know, respectable.
In our remaining time, where I want to take this is in studying for this, and I don't know, a 16th of what the two of you, either of you knows, but I did try to do my homework for this.
Yeah.
And one of the things that struck me is all the conversation we've missed because we didn't have a robust understanding of Malcolm X's time in Roxbury. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One, his journey in our prison system. I remember talking with Reginald Dwayne Betts, the lawyer and poet who is putting libraries in prisons and worked really hard as close as possible to put one in one of Malcolm X's previous jail cells. Mm-hmm. The journey that he went on, the way the incarceration system both affected him and supported him, his relationship with law enforcement, what that tells us about our history. It's like we missed a whole conversation that would have made us smarter and better. Dark.
I think another, I think the more important conversation is that the reason why Elijah Muhammad and so many people embraced the Nation of Islam in Boston is because we had UNIA folks who are Garveyites. Who are West
Remind
Indian.
Remind us what UNIA is.
So it's Marcus Garvey's special movement to go back to Africa and like self-determination of black folks.
Movement.
The Pan-African movement.
Mm-hmm.
But also
Universal Negro Improvement
Association.
Association.
Yes. But also, it also had this idea of black folks doing for self and a whole bunch of Afro-Caribbean, Afro-Latino identity inside Boston. And that's a unique thing that Boston has in of itself. And Malcolm grew up in that. He grew up with the jazz, leaning towards Islamic.
His mother was from Guyana, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So they read West Indian newspapers growing up in the house. And when they came to Boston, it was amplified. Malcolm never saw black people the way they could be until he arrived in Roxbury. And he doesn't become Malcolm X if he's not a son of Roxbury.
And I want to point that out, Kelly Carter Jackson. He says in his autobiography, it was the first time when I came to Roxbury that I saw a community of black people together and thriving in the way that I did there. So, Kelly, you are our sense maker. We've taken in a lot of information here. We've got a minute or so left.
Oh, gosh.
Right? So just make sense of it all. But no, give us a little context to process this in the next day or two as people are thinking about the conversation the two of you have just given us.
You know, I want people to really grapple with history and memory. I want people to know what happened, which is the history, the lived experiences of Malcolm X. But I also want us to pay attention to memory, how we memorialize, how we preserve, how we perpetuate the legacy of Malcolm X is equally important to the history that happened. And while we can't change history, it's just a fact, we can't absolutely change memory. Memory is political and memory is ongoing. And I think these are real things that we have to grapple with when we think about how we preserve people's past stories.
And Dart, I'm going to leave closing thought to you. We've got about 30 seconds.
The idea of Malcolm X belonging to everyone is fine, but remember, Malcolm X doesn't become Malcolm X if he's not in Roxbury, doesn't always visit Roxbury, and isn't bolstered by the feeling, the love, and the understanding that he gained by being a Roxbury resident.
So part of what I'm taking away from this conversation coming into it, I was expecting to learn about Malcolm X and Roxbury, but I understand now there's also Roxbury and Malcolm X.
Malcolm X is Roxbury, just like I'm Roxbury.
All right, Dart Adams is a journalist, historian, host of Dart Against Humanity and Boston Legends, two podcasts. Kelly Carter Jackson is an associate professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College and our regular guide to Yes And. Really want to thank both of you for being here. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There is more ahead. We've just been talking a little bit about Boston's jazz scene. Coming up, we're going to dive deeper into the question of jazz, specifically Wayne Shorter, jazz saxophonist and composer, and his impact on two local jazz legends. That's what's next. I'm Tiziana Dearing. You're listening to Radio Boston. Wally's, Scullers, The Hi-Hat, Chicken Lane, the Savoy Cafe, all legendary jazz clubs, Wally's and Scholars are still here. Boston has long been known as a paradise for jazz, a mecca for musicians and audiences alike. And that's why earlier this month, when renowned saxophonist Wayne Shorter died, the community mourned together. And that includes local jazz legends deeply influenced by his work and by playing with him. Today, we remember Shorter with Danilo Perez, founder and artistic director of the Global Jazz Institute at Berkeley, and a member of the Wayne Shorter Quartet, and also with drummer Terry Lynn Carrington, the founder and artistic director of Berkeley's Institute for Jazz and Gender Justice. We caught up with the two of them earlier this week, and I started by asking Danilo to tell us in his own words who Wayne Shorter was.
For me, Wayne Shorter was an eminent teacher, a soothsayer, like a shaman, a second father. He was a messenger of peace in the world, a creative guardian. All of those type of things. He was a mentor, a huge mentor in my life. His impact on me went from music to life, basically. I think he really was very crucial and made me understand that when you are a musician, when you are an artist, you are channeling your life story as you play. And in order to continue pushing forward the art, you have to remember who you are every day. Who am I? That's the question that Wayne Shorter asked me. Who am I? Who are you? Look at yourself in the mirror and say, who are you? So becoming a human and then transfer those stories and the instrument and the piano and my music, what I write. Write what you love. You know, the greatest lesson I got from him was play and compose music you want the world to be like.
So, Terry Lynn, I want to stay with this, both play and compose, because Wayne Shorter did both, you know, played tenor saxophone, later soprano saxophone, a prolific and really well-respected jazz composer. You listed one of your favorite Wayne Shorter songs as Infant Eyes. This is a little from the 1966 album Speak No Evil. And when we asked you when you first, like, did you remember the first time you heard Wayne Shorter's music, you told our producer he was always there.
Correct. Well, because I started playing so young, I don't remember a time that I was not aware of him. I grew up, of course, loving the Miles Davis Quintet, but also his solo records. My dad had them. So I just feel like he was always there. So for me, the greatest thing in the world was when I finally met him, and I think I was about 21. And then I got the chance to play with him. And he was such an iconic figure, a larger than life figure, you know, that I couldn't believe that I had this opportunity to audition for him and to play with him.
So let's actually do that. I was actually going to pick up and play some yes and yes or no there, but I want to go instead to each of you playing with Wayne Shorter. So Terry Lynn Carrington, this is Drummer's Song. It's the 2017 Detroit Jazz Festival, Wayne Shorter Quartet, and you're playing. So let's now play a little sound. Danilo, this is 2014. You're playing with the Wayne Shorter Quartet. You're a member of the Wayne Shorter Quartet. Here's a little sound.
What is so unique about working with Wayne is as you start to get deep into his world, you start to get inspired in how he applies the creative process to all aspects of his life. And that is really inspiring. You know, he was wondering always, what is music for? What is the purpose of music? Which comes first, life or music? You know, how do you apply creative thinking daily? And that's the inspiration. You know, before we go to play every night, we had a ritual that we hold our head together. And then he would say, let's make a movie, you know, stuff like that. He would make it so before you play, you were already having fun. So genius, so childlike, so empowering. And he really is a master of, you know, what makes us fearful of the unexpected. He always was asking about that. You can't rehearse the unknown, you know? So there was no way you have to peel off all this stuff and go for it, you know? And he was always looking for that experience in that moment. He wasn't interested in recapping something that we got to it the day before. He would say, let's find another way. He was always inspiring us to grow.
I want to play a little sound. This is Wayne Shorter talking with John Batiste on The Late Show in 2017.
And the intent now is to put away everything that was learned, the studied stuff. Again, I always refer, because Miles is the only one who would talk like this. He would say, Wayne, do you ever feel like you want to play like you don't know how to play? And then he said, do you feel like you'd like to play music that doesn't sound like music? And I have a tape of Charlie Parker giving a lesson, and the student says, Mr. Parker, I have to learn all these scales, I have to memorize all these scales. And Bird said, yes, and after you finish learning them, forget them.
So, of course, Wayne Shorter played with the second Miles Davis quintet. Terry Lynn, both of you, I want to hear from both of you on this. You chuckled, I'll have you go first.
Well, one, it was really nice to hear his voice telling that story. I never heard the Charlie Parker tape part before. And yeah, I think that's any great musician. I think the idea is to learn all the things that you have to learn, but then to forget them so that you can just connect with something other than theory. Wayne used to say sometimes about musicians, especially younger ones that have come out of school recently, that they sound academic. And I think, you know, that was his way of saying, you know, they have to live more life so that they can actually play something that connects to other people's humanity. You can't teach someone that, you know. What you learn in school are just tools to hopefully be able to pull that out of your own life. When he played, he was very intense. So especially like when I played with him in the 80s and it was an electric band, he was sweating, you know, more than anyone else, you know, playing with everything he had. You know, you could see the veins in his head, and it was just so intense. And I learned about playing with that kind of intensity really from him, because if he was whatever he was, 25 years or more, 30 years older than me, and he had that kind of intention and intensity and determination and life force with his playing, I knew that I needed to bring that as well and really be in the moment. So that was really one of the other big things I learned from playing with him, is how to be in the moment.
So I want to, Danilo, I'll turn to you, but I want to insert a little more of his music here. This is not from the 80s. It's actually 1964. It's in Italy. He's playing with the Miles Davis Quintet. He's soloing This Is Autumn Leaves. Now, Danilo, for people who don't know Autumn Leaves, right, that's not sort of the core basic Autumn Leaves that you hear from a high school jazz band. He's taking it all kinds of places, and I'm struck by that intensity and that living in the moment that you were talking about.
Yeah, because he was about telling stories, and he was living every minute and second as his last time in this earth. That's one thing I learned from him. He never took for granted any time. I mean, I've seen him applying his creative thinking in everything, and even a conversation, even at the hotel, even looking at a painting. He would be practicing all day. So by the time he got to the stage, he had all this imagination. Right before we start playing, he would say, let's play music that doesn't sound like music. And he got that from Miles, right? And then he'll tell you a story of Charlie Parker before the gig. And he makes you think. It's like he would never be forceful about it. Like, you have to do this. He would just say, hey, what about if we play some UFO material? Something that we never heard. What kind of music you think the alien will welcome? You know? So I imagine him in those times having a sense, another sensibility to the music, in terms of like, he was seeing images. He was seeing the autumn leaves But he also added, like, what it would Aaron Leaf would be in Jupiter or in the Milky Way. That was Wayne, you know. He would never waste time to be creative, never. He never wasted 1 second of his life to be creative. I remember one time he had CNN on really loud, and he was composing, and I was with him there. And I say, what the hell is this? He said, I gotta write contrafact music, Danilo. We gotta write contrafact. So I put CNN, and I see the kind of news that are happening, the bad news. Then I wanna write hopeful music. That's what's happening.
So contrafact literally being the opposite.
Exactly, exactly. He said, we have to see, Wayne was about, it was about like a human being who constantly celebrating the incomprehensible phenomenon known as life itself. You know, he was a practitioner of the finding the melodies of the art of living for me.
So I'm going to bring in another jazz voice. We're speaking with Terry Lynn Carrington and Danilo Perez, both professors at Berkeley, both played with, strongly influenced by Wayne Shorter. We talked with Mehmet Ali Sanlikol, who's a composer and musician, Berkeley alum, teaches at the New England Conservatory now. And he told an interesting story about his student life and Wayne Shorter. Here he is.
I came to this country in 1993 to go to Berkeley, and I couldn't go back to Turkey. And so I ended up having to stay in the dormitory over that Christmas break. And it was a lonely time. I made myself busy by launching into arranging a big band chart in order to enter a class. There were like about 25 tunes or so listed. In order to enter this class, you had to arrange one of them. None of them spoke to me, but a tune by Wayne Shorter called Speak No Evil. And I remember, you know, those couple of weeks during that Christmas break, I would be listening to that record, Speak No Evil. And Black Market, a Weather Report album. I remember just flipping those over and over and over and over again, and at the same time writing this arrangement, which was my literally first ever big band arrangement. To this day, you know, when I look back to that period, the connection I had with Mr. Shorter was a very special one that got me through a rough period.
And of course, the Weather Report, he was one of the founding members. Terry Lynn Carrington, what can he bring to the students of jazz today? How do you use the music to teach them? I mean, it's going to take life, right, to have enough life, to be improvisational and forward-looking, creative. But what can we teach young students from Shorter's music?
His music is so hopeful. It reflects how he is as a person. And you can hear that. You can feel it and you can hear it in his music. One of the things he likes to say all the time, and in fact, wear on a hat or a T-shirt, is never give up. And you can hear that in every note that he plays. You can hear the polarity of things like pain and suffering, as well as love and joy. You can hear that in every single note that he plays. Is it sad? Is it happy? It's both. It's all wrapped up into one. He's found a universal way to address all things human with every song, every note, every piece of music he composed. That's why if he played just a few lines on a Joni Mitchell album, you know, it still slayed you. You know, it was still brilliant. And she herself said, you know, he was very pictorial, you know, I guess as a player. You know, he played sonically, you know, the images that she was writing about, she was singing about. And I think that some of those things are, I won't say forgotten these days, but I think it's very difficult to do. And I think that young musicians, there's a lot of lessons there to learn.
So, Danilo, I'll ask you a last question. But before I do, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a little bit of then and now. So we're going to start with Yes or No, which, Terry Lynn, you mentioned earlier. This is from 1965 album Juju. All All right, and then it's not now, but it's fast forward 20 years. Now we've got What You Dream from the 1985 album Atlantis, When You Dream.
When You Dream.
Which you both cited as kind of an underappreciated work of Wayne Shorter's. So here's a little bit of When You Dream.
Really?
So that's a 20-year stretch, right? And Danilo, 20 years later, you're playing with Wayne Shorter. And 20 years from now, where do you see the influence of his music in jazz? When you look, you're the one that talked about he was like, how can we rehearse? How can we play? What's going to happen in the future? So what is going to happen in the future 20 years from now?
He reminded us that it's okay to be vulnerable. That's one thing that I keep in my search, to open oneself and take chances, not be afraid of the unknown, because it's in that process of opening our heart. That's what he taught me. It's the opening up of our heart to changes in life that the fight for happiness draw our musical path. This path that he has opened for us welcome all the music of the world, and a perspective that to me emphasizes interaction of voices, and instead of a self-centered position, you know, like this is myself alone. He was about collective ideas instead of individual ones. His music always inspired us to keep changing, to keep representing, to keep cultivating our minds, to keep forward, to remind ourselves, do not be afraid. Do people say sky's the limit? I think with those kind of memories, sky is not the limit. Wayne left us a lot of doors that we have to open and walk through. We have to go. As long as we keep it in our heart and our memory, we will have enough spiritual material, spiritual food to move forward and create music nobody heard. I'm excited about making music that nobody heard with that dream.
Let's go out on Footprints. This is Wayne Shorter playing with the Miles Davis Quintet, 1967. Terry Lynn Carrington is the founder and artistic director of Berkeley's Institute for Jazz and Gender Justice. Danilo Perez is founder and artistic director of the Global Jazz Institute at Berkeley and was a member of the Wayne Shorter Quartet. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And tomorrow night at the Berkeley Performance Center, Terry Lynn Carrington and Social Science will perform a show dedicated to Wayne Shorter. Music starts at 8 p.m. For more information, you can visit celebrityseries.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.